Welcome to the Interspecies Future Podcast. This is episode 3, Sensing the Interspecies. I'm your host, Bridie Addison-Child. Interspecies Future is an initiative by Berlin-based art foundation LAS, marking the beginning of a multi-decade civilizational journey in advancing the new rights and opportunities for non-human life on Earth, as made possible by the emergence of planetary-scale computing. In this series, we're looking at how we can redesign relationships between humans and non-humans using new technologies. But to do this, we need to sense or understand non-humans. Naturalist science has already done this in various ways, but developments in robotics, satellite and molecular sensing afford a massively increased capacity for mapping the lives of non-humans. In this episode, we're considering what it means to translate the non-human world through new sensing technologies. And our guests are Martin Vakelsky and Xiaowei Wang.
We try to really highlight, well, what does it mean to be an individual animal? In the end, I think we will have a completely new understanding of animals and animal culture in the world.
Tech is really transforming both agriculture, but I think the relationship of traditional villages to nature, or I guess the concept of nature.
In this conversation, we covered the impressive technical scale of Project Icarus, which is using satellite sensing to redefine how we track animals. But we also asked what it means to sense non-human animals rather than surveil them. And we discussed the importance of Eastern philosophies for the interspecies. I was left feeling hopeful about the emergent knowledge we have to gain when we combine both a micro understanding of animals as individuals with the macro capacities of technology. If we could start with a brief introduction from both of you and just an overview of your work, and if you could take that one first, please, Martin.
I'm Martin Vakelsky. I'm a director at the Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior and a professor of ecology at the University of Konstanz. And I'm really trying to understand animals and animals around the globe. So sort of traditionally animal ecologist, but really trying to link into what animals can tell us.
And you're also, let's not miss out, director of Project Icarus. So as I understand it, Project Icarus is using antenna on the International Space Station to track animals. Could you just tell us a little bit more about the technical scale of that project to start off? What is Project Icarus? How is it working? What are you doing?
We call it the global cell. So it's in principle just a receiver system in orbit to receive information from animals all around the world. You have this AI or this sort of information on the animals that does the local decoding. And then you just send an excerpt, a summary of what the animals are doing through some communication channel. And that is exciting because you can use AI on chip now. It's so easy and the chips are so small and so good that you can, if you have observed animals before and you can classify it, then you can put the AI onto the chip. And that then tells you, oh, animal is now super nervous, or it's now grazing, or it's running, or whatever. I mean, lots of things, or sickness behavior. It has a, I mean, for example, we have now the wild boar that have the swine fever. We can detect that easily within 20 minutes. it's amazing. It's just by the ear wiggling. But in principle, it's in a way just a cell phone. A simple cell phone system for animals that works autonomously all around the world.
I just love that. Like, I love that you're tracking animals from space. It feels very space age to me. we will come back to some of those themes in a moment. But first, Xiaowei, perhaps you could also introduce yourself and the scope of your work.
I'm Xiaowei Wang. I'm a writer, artist, coder and organizer, and I write a lot about the intersection between tech and culture, and particularly tech's impact on society. So I spend a lot of my time thinking about the ways that tech is changing both human and human relationships and human and non-human animal relationships. I recently wrote a book called Blockchain Chicken Farm, and it's about tech in rural China and the ways that tech is really transforming both agriculture, but I think the relationship of traditional villages to nature, or I guess the concept of nature. One of the chapters looks at the ways that artificial intelligence is being used by big tech companies like Alibaba to basically scale up pig farming and pork production, and using AI as a way of controlling for disease. And so disease prevention that happens in a lot of these factory farms. I'm curious for you, Martin, because I was just reading about your Icarus project. If you wanted to just tell us more about that. But then also, when I was reading about your project, it says that they're actually tracking like the feelings or like behaviors of the animals more than like location. Curious about that.
Mm-hmm. We not only measure position, but we measure behavior, interaction, sound, also the environment. And that's super exciting because you have these measurement devices that you can, say, sample 100 times a second what the animal is doing. And from that, if you measure acceleration, the change in movement in space, you can basically recreate the entire behavior of the animal. I think it became clear that, we can actually, with these modern technologies, we can have the animals talk to us in a way that nobody else could do before. I mean, no culture in human history could do before. And we can do it across the planet. In the end, I think we will have a completely new understanding of animals and animal culture in the world. And I think this is something that's super exciting, and we are sort of at the cusp of realizing that.
I'm curious, because you said the term animal culture, and I love that term, because I think so often it's like, I mean, we have whole institutions dedicated to the study of human culture. I'm really recently thinking through and very much influenced by the ways I have been brought up to think about animals, particularly like within Chinese culture. And so trying to bring more of that into my work.
So how were you brought up? I mean, what do you think about animals, or what's, because that's super exciting to have that view, I think.
Yeah. So I was trying to explain this to a friend the other day, like about the Chinese zodiac, because in the Chinese zodiac, there's 12 animals. This year is the tiger year, and this year is technically my like year, birth year. And I think there's a lot of ways in which people are like, oh, acting like a tiger, or humans acting like tigers. Tigers are, you know, XYZ, aggressive, or have all these things that are kind of in our imagination, right? And when I started actually thinking about like my relatives that live in rural villages, as well as reading more into the history of the Chinese zodiac, it's really based a lot more on kind of nature worship and shamanism. And so it's not about putting human attributes onto the animals, but it's actually about like creating this respect for them as part of this bigger like ecology or world that we live in. That's like one example of just things that I've been thinking about in terms of Chinese zodiac stuff.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's actually interesting. I also grew up on close to a farm. So my grandfather had a farm, and it was one of these traditional farms. You know, you had cows and sheep and pigs and chicken and whatnot. And in my holidays, I was always bringing the cows to the fields, you know, where they had to graze because they were outside. And I think I realized that they're all individual animals. They're not the same. They have their own will, their own thinking, their own understanding of what's going on. And in a way, I think that sort of transferred into what I tried to do in biology, that we tried to really highlight, well, what does it mean to be an individual animal? Because they come together in different groups, I mean, with different species, but also within the same species, there are different individuals that have different traits. I mean, totally different, as humans are very different, obviously. I mean, it's also maybe because in Germany you had Humboldt, and Humboldt was the first to really propagate, well, you should understand all the interactions of particles. And if you understand that, you can understand the whole thing. And that was more towards physics and chemistry, but now, you know, it's also about biology. So this really showed us, well, there's so much more knowledge within animals that we can potentially read out. And I think that's where, if you bring this wisdom, this knowledge together, then you have this emergent new knowledge. So you have not just more of the same, you have a completely new emergent wisdom. And I think that's sort of where Icarus comes from, that we said we need a global system. It should be seamless, you know, just totally easy for everybody in Bhutan, in Niger, in Chile, wherever, doesn't matter, to have these animals talk to them. And I think that's where we think we can give animals a voice, and we can also, in a way, protect them individually, because you would never kill your guard dog, your avalanche dog, your sniffing dog. I mean, you treasure them.
With what you were just saying, Martin, you're talking about this new kind of knowledge, this way of sensing and understanding non-human animals that maybe we haven't had before. I'm wondering what we can predict with that work, and what we're going to get from those predictions, you know, kind of what are the concrete real world consequences?
I mean, I think there are very simple consequences that, for example, you tag a bunch of wild dogs in Kruger National Park. A friend of ours is doing that. And you see that on the tags, they move differently. And then you go there because you know, well, they probably have snares, or one of them has a snare. And yes, sure enough, he removes the snare, treats that animal, and that's makes the entire difference between an increasing population and a population that's dying out. So that's sort of immediate action that you can implement to save animals. But then I think it's almost like 20 years ago, we couldn't imagine that we have a prediction for traffic. But now, you know, you have the cars linked together by cell phones, and you know precisely where the traffic jam is, how long it takes you, where to go if there is a jam. And I think those kind of things are what we can expect from animals. So the stuff that we didn't even know that we want, we need, we can have. And I think that some of those will be long-term predictions on climate, on living conditions, on water relations in the world, but also on natural catastrophes. And I know that a lot of people are still very critical about that, and I'm very critical myself about that. But, you know, we did a lot of observations and experiments now, and also we do our internal predictions, for example, for Mount Etna, based on the goats that we have there and other animals. Will it erupt tomorrow? And we've been right a lot of times now. I mean, it's actually really exciting that apparently, at least in some places, animals may be giving you a local prediction of what's going on. And for us, this is super exciting, because it gives the power of the local predictions back to the people. And it enables them to really link that information together, not just on a super local scale, but on a scale that they couldn't do before, 20, 50 kilometers. And that's really where it matters for people. So I think all those transitions will be major.
I would also add that, like, I think that some forms of these, like, you know, watching animals to see what they do as like an indicator, it's also, as Martin alluded to, you know, there's many, many communities throughout history who have like practiced that. You know, I always remember my grandma like telling these stories that I thought she was just like a total nut, because she grew up in a very to even say it was agricultural might be generous, but like, you know, she grew up in a time where they were like trying to raise food, and she would have all these like little parables, just like, oh, you have to like, you know, if you're ever lost in the woods, like, you should watch this animal to see what they eat. And, like, you can eat the same thing. That's how you know it's safe. Which I just had never thought about, you know. But just stories like that, or just, you know, when she was growing up, there was both earthquakes and floods. And she would always, like, recount, like, how, like, just, like, a day or two before, like, you know, everyone in her village would notice, like, these sudden behavioral changes in both, like, the wild dogs, but also just the different various animals. And, you know, even when there was a flood, there's this whole thing where she was, like, you would follow, like, the animals to, like, the non-human animals to, like, try and save yourself because they were much smarter than the humans. And I think, like, that has since been lost in our very urbanized, like, both, I mean, just the city as an environment that's very confusing for humans, too, and our, like, very digitized culture.
Wow, that is super exciting. I mean, it's so interesting because these stories, I mean, I've heard these stories or seen them in the literature about China, but you know that from your grandmother. That's actually super exciting.
I mean, I feel like that's the paradox, right? Is that I think there's a lot of people, like people who are in the science and technology realm who are like, this is what your grandmother is saying is very anecdotal and like it's not actual data. And I'm like, well, she survived and I'm here. So she must have done something right by like following around like the weasels to higher ground. But yeah, so I think it's like, it's fascinating to like, you know, now see like, oh, like that's folk knowledge and that's not scientific. And so now more and more people are like trying to, yeah, surface data of some kind.
I mean, I'm totally fascinated that you know about these stories from your grandma in China, because those are the classic examples that this really works. We've seen that all over the world, actually. So, I mean, Banda Aceh, where the big tsunami was. There are outlying islands, Simoilwe, where the kids actually in school learn songs about animals showing you what's happening. And if the water buffaloes run and the chicken fly crazy, then run up with them to the highlands immediately. Let everything behind. And, you know, Banda Aceh had 250,000 dead people. And in Simoilwe, I think there were 7 or so. And it's actually much closer to the center of the tsunami. And then you have people from the Niger Delta write us and tell us, well, can you send us some tags? We want to understand why our weaver birds built their nests at certain altitude levels above the Niger in the trees. And we actually predict the flooding in the coming year from that. And then it never ends. And then in South Africa, we do a project where animals protect animals because you want the other animals to tell you where the poachers are coming through a landscape. And they are always out there. They don't lie to you. You know, if they are nervous, if they are excited, then they just tell you. And I think that's the real power, that you have intelligence on board that you can actually fine tune even to the individual. So if one individual is an ear wiggler, then yeah, you have to downscale your threshold. But you can do that now. It's not magic. And also the good thing is, if it's not an endangered animal, everybody can see those data. That's also super important. So we now actually implemented systems where you don't have to code yourself, but you can just put bits and pieces of code together, you sort of click it together graphically, and then you analyze your data yourself. So, a farmer in Chad can now just go to the internet and analyze the data of her own animals in the farm.
That reminds me, so a few years ago, I saw this talk from Ross Anderson, who's like a computer security professor in the UK. And he was talking about data and data security and privacy for non-human animals. And his example was that, you know, we have so much geolocated data now that it could fall into the hands of people like poachers. And he was talking about this phenomena of people taking photos of animals and putting them onto Flickr, and that their GPS locations are still available. And so I went and took a look, and I scraped all this Flickr data, and it was wild. You could really just map out the locations of, you know, rhinoceroses and elephants taken by people on safari. And I'm curious, how do you all approach, like, animal data security and privacy at Project Icarus?
Yeah, that's a super important aspect. The good thing is the data, the payload data, sort of the data that are sent through the system, they are coded in a way that nobody can just, you know, listen into a signal from an Icarus tag or from any of the other tags we're using and know immediately where this animal is. And that's important because if you generally know that there is an animal in the area, that doesn't really help you. So in Kruger, for example, where they have, I mean, we are working on the rhinos, we have ear tags for the rhinos, and we get their position in near real time. That's really important to have that near real time position not being public. And that's where we used, you know, every skill that anybody has to code stuff is in there. So I mean, that's in that time frame, you will not be able to decode that signal. It's just maybe you can within a few days or so, but then it doesn't matter anymore because you know anyways that there are rhinos in the area. I think what we realize is actually that it's much more important to have that location for the good guys that try to protect them, and for the bad guys. You know, there you need the animals to tell you where they are. You can't use other rangers because often they are, you know, they are threatened by the mafia. They are bought by the mafia. They are, you know, they can't do anything about it. They don't want to kill the animals, but they have to give out these locations. But they can also only give out approximate locations. And if we know the precise locations in real time and the animals tell us somebody's coming towards the animal, towards your rhino, then you can send out people to protect them. I think that's super important. And if there is old information in there, it's not that helpful. It's not that important. I mean, we haven't seen really any problems from that, except if the information is really fresh.
I do think it's interesting that we've moved here into acknowledging a potentially more sinister side of the use of this tech or the collection of this data. And it reminds me of, in your book, Xiao, where you talk about the way that big tech companies are using AI in industrial pig farming. And your rendering of the use of that is quite dystopian, I think quite rightly. You say it's kind of creating this very closed, static world. And then in the end, you say that, quote, the version of life under AI being sold by big tech companies presents a reassuring, controlled world where unfettered optimization and automation are inevitable. And you later say, in this context, AI is not the balm to any problem, it is just one piece in the ever-hungry quest for scale. So balancing, like, maybe hopefulness in Project Icarus and dystopianness in industrial pig farming, I'd love to hear from you, Xiaowei, what you think about how we should be using AI to sense other species.
I always go back to this phrase that comes from this organizing group called Stop LAPD Spying, and they work out of LA, and they think through tech and its impacts on our world. And they always say the opposite of surveillance is relation and relationship. And I think relationship is a really good word. Like when I think about AI being used to, I mean, the whole process of hog farming is just wild anyways, like the level of, you know, breed selection, like the meat, like how that meat is assessed, like, you know, playing music for the pigs so that they have better tasting meat. It's really like this terribly controlled environment. And then you have AI that's basically just surveillance, monitoring them to like optimize them to be, to have more delicious pigs at a faster rate, right? But I think on the opposite end of that, there, you know, like Project Icarus, right, where it's about how do we use tech to deepen relationship and relation, and not just in the way that, you know, I think there's a fluffy way we talk about like social media or Twitter, and it's like, well, aren't you connecting there? But it's not about deepening relationship, right? So I think that, you know, anything that can allow us to deepen our relationship to non-human animals and their environment, I think I feel really hopeful about those uses of technology. Mm-hmm. But I think I would love to also just hear more about, or we could discuss more about, like, governance and how a mm-hmm. lot of these tech solutions fit into governance and policy change. Because like in terms of policy change, what I mean by this is like, I think there's one end of it where like in the face of climate crisis, right, we're trying to both make like these kind of ancient practices legible and also at the same time, like I think your work speaks to the importance of using new technologies to actually like create another kind of legibility or just like surface this data. And so yeah, I guess like in terms of Project Icarus, I'm curious how what does the governance piece look like? Is the UN like, you know, super psyched on this?
Well, I think not yet. I think the governance is difficult because a lot of people haven't heard about this idea before. I mean, in some way they, when you talk to them, they think, oh, this could be interesting. But I had this, you know, this early revelation when we started Icarus about 2003 or so, I talked to some of the bosses at NASA and they said, oh, I've never heard about that. Why should we ever track animals from space? I mean, why would you like to know about animals and bring it together? And what is that all about? But now they are fully on board. You know, they totally came around and now they really want to do it because they understand how important it is. So I think it's... there's still a bit of an uphill battle, but also WHO, I mean, the One Health Initiative, they know exactly you can only have a global health if you treat animals well, if you treat your animals around the house, around the farms, around the cities well, and the wild animals. And, you know, sometimes you have to stay a little bit away, you have to give them space. But I think that's a major shift in our understanding of what we need from each other and what we have to give each other to survive. So I would think there's a major shift coming up and there are more and more people understanding that.
Mm-hmm. When I was researching the AI being used to farm pigs and mm-hmm. I started looking into just industrial farming in China specifically, because I think at least in the US, we import a lot of food, which I don't think a ton of people know about, but you know, like you see garlic and it's like all of the garlic is from China, even though we have garlic farmers in the US, and just things like fish or all these actually farmed animals being imported. And it was really, you know, fascinating because I was like, I don't know why people aren't talking about zoonotic disease more. I mean, I guess after COVID, we're talking about zoonotic disease more.
Exactly.
But just like that interface of knowing like where wild animals are, or like how they're being affected by the push from industrialized animal farming, I think it's so crucial. And it's incredibly exciting to hear that the WHO like is, you know, understands like this is really key and like, you know, an important part of scientific knowledge. Yeah.
And I think the key is also that we know so little about that because you still have people constantly blaming the large fruit bats in Africa, for example, for transmitting Ebola. And it's just not the case. And there's so many diseases that are blamed on certain bats, and it's just not there. I mean, if you look through the literature, it's really actually hard to publish this because even in the biology realm, people are so brainwashed that they think certain animals have diseases and others don't. And I mean, all of those connections are so important to understand. If you go to Mecca, you have MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, that's being brought by camels every year to Mecca. And it would be so easy to just, you know, track the camels and see if they have infections. And if they do, well, they shouldn't go to Mecca. They should stay outside and get healthy again. So it's a fairly simple system, but you just have to understand what's going on. But the good thing is, I think people are tuning into that. And I think it's also changing the way how, mass manufacturing of animal products is being seen. Again, I would compare it to slavery 200 years ago. You know, at a time, this was, that's just how you do it. And some years later, you know, it switched, and now it's a taboo, and that's good. And I'm not totally against using animals. I mean, having animals, because that's has always been a way of life. That's totally fine, but you have to treat them well. So I think that's coming.
In what you were just saying there, Martin, about oppression and social taboo, it reminded me of something else in your book, Xiaowei, where you're talking about the idea of the human as a construct. And you say the idea of who is considered human and what it means to be human has for hundreds of years been a political project by those in power. So on that, if we're thinking again of this idea of sensing and relating to other animals, how do each of you think that we need to change that construct or that understanding of the human in contemporary culture, in response to the challenges that we're facing in the ecological crisis?
Yeah, I think that's the big question, right? Is, you know, how do we start to form relationships with other beings in a way that's not just like, oh, we have to simply like categorize them as like, you know, because the project of like being human, what I meant by that historically is in the US at least, you know, for hundreds of years, non-white immigrants, Black people, like they weren't considered human in the sense that they could like own property or vote. And I think in the US, it's like this ever ongoing project of like trying to like be human. But there's also like extending beyond that, like how do we be in relationship with these other beings in our environment that's not just about like the constant like putting like being like, okay, you can have these rights, but actually genuinely see that, you know, like what does it mean to call a tiger kin or relationship? There's like, you know, parts of both Shintoism and like ancient Chinese like religions in which your ancestors are like in other animal forms, right? There's also like, I love the story of the Hutong weasel in China, which is this, I think it's called the Siberian weasel, but Huangshulang is the Chinese name. And it's like, you're absolutely not supposed to kill it because it's like a roving ghost that will steal your soul if you tried to kill it. But it's also an amazing, it eats like rats and mice and like all kinds of insects, right, that are pests. And so I think there's ways of like being in relation with these other beings that feels very important.
No, I think that's really exactly the way to go in the future. And I think it's also one of the biggest transitions in human history. I mean, if you think about it, you know, like since 2000 years or so, our philosophy, at least the Western philosophy, has basically been the same. It's sort of the Greek philosophy that perpetrated everything. And then, I mean, that even went into the foundation of the United States and many other countries. And I think now we are starting to realize that there's something missing. In a way, it's something missing from being human. And this is probably what actually in the end will save us. So it will take another decade or two to really be sort of a taboo or a dogma around the world. But I think we are at the cusp of really one of the biggest changes in humankind. I mean, for one, that we are globally connecting, and also that we can connect life on a global level, and we can understand what life is telling us. And I think that's such a major transition. So, I mean, if you think about the internet, that linking people together has been the start of it. But now linking all life forms together and really make each understand each other in novel ways that we couldn't do before. And I think that's super exciting. Well, I would love to know from you how you see the future of that. I mean, when do you see these big transitions coming? I mean, you've thought a lot more about policies and sort of, I think, the human angle of that. So when do you think, you know, the big abolition will come? When will we get rid of animal slavery? When is the big transition?
I'm like, oh, can I predict the future? I feel like, I think this is also influenced by like being a practicing Buddhist, where it's like there's this line in Buddhism where people are like, oh, like the world that we live in now is just as violent and filled with suffering as the same world, like, you know, thousands of years ago when the Buddha was sitting under the tree. And I think it's one of those things, right, where it's like it's happening now, right? There are communities and there are people and there's farmers and there's, you know, environmental activists and people who are like already in the practice of being in a different kind of relation to non-human animals. And I think like, you know, are facing constant opposition to their causes. I think, to be quite honest, I think there's also like a group of people who, you know, when I think of the head of like big agribusinesses or like people like that who are just invested, you know, like they don't want to change because it makes them money. And I think there's always just going to be those contradictions in the world. But at the same time, it's about, yeah, if we can just, if some of us can like at least continue to steward a world for the next generation that isn't totally devoid of non-human animals, like I think that's just the balance.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Sorry.
No, I think that's
optimistic.
I mean, I think I would be more optimistic. I mean, not that there will be a complete 100% change. I mean, as you said, but I would think with all the signs that are on the horizon now, I mean, I would say within 2 or 3 decades, we'll see a major shift because it's a generational shift and it's a shift in our complete approach to how we see the world. And I think, I mean, I almost see it like, you know, the advent of philosophy some thousands of years ago, that now there's an advent of a new way of living with all the other creatures. And I think that will change our relationship with our own kind a lot. I mean, these local things that we're doing now, also the local conflicts and all this nonsense, I think people are getting really tired of that. It's not the way to be anymore.
I really hope you're right. I'm also, I think, biased because I live in the U.S. where we don't even know how to treat other humans. or like have a good governance structure amongst humans. So perhaps my less than optimistic view is influenced by that.
Well, you know, maybe we need both a cynical and a optimistic perspective. Thank you both so much for this conversation and for joining the Interspecies Future podcast.
I'm excited to meet you in person, Martin.
Well, same here. Yeah, it'd be great. Thank you. See you soon.
This podcast is produced on the occasion of the Interspecies Future Symposium in July 2022, co-hosted by Light Art Space and the Museum für Naturkunde in Berlin. The symposium has been orchestrated and convened by the chairs, Kenrick Aledo McDowell and Jonathan Ledyard, with Bettina Carmes and Johannes Vogel. The wider programme has been curated by Light Artspace Head of Programmes Amira Gad, with Corinne Minat as co-organiser of the Interspecies Future Symposium and surrounding activities. This series is produced and hosted by me, Bridie Addison-Child. It is a reduced listening production supported by Light Artspace.